Okay, each one of you that were going to volunteer are off of the hook. Mr. Smith has made it. I haven't had a chance to talk to Mr. Smith, but he did give me a paper here with some of his background on it, and I'd like to read that while he's getting settled and getting ready to go. George D. Smith is founder of Signature Books, publishers of Western American history, journals, and literature, including Michael Quinn's two probing volumes on the Mormon hierarchy, Todd Compton's biography of 33 of Joseph Smith's plural wives, a collection of illustrated one-page descriptions of each of 27 of the world's religions, from the Amish to the, I can't even say that word, Cervantes, entitled The World of Faith. He had been a media consultant, award-winning film of PBS, Mormons, Missionaries in the World. He has written articles for Dialogue, Free Inquiry, John Whitmer's Historical Journal, Journal of American Mormon History, and Sunstone. He is married to Camilla Smith, who edits the U.S. Berkeley Special Collections Newsletter and is chair of the National Conference for Community and Justice in Northern California. They live in San Francisco, have raised five children, enjoy film festivals, public radio, and bicycling. Mr. Smith.
That's approximately correct. description of this topic as it was printed is a little bit rearranged. If you notice, the lines don't quite match if you try to read what it says. So I'll read that to you just so we get that straight to start off with. It says, one of the antecedents of Mormon polygamy began early in the Protestant Reformation in 1531 as German dreamers practiced reciprocal spouse exchange called spiritual marriage. The Munster Restoration prophet John Bockelson, his nemesis Martin Luther, Henry VIII, John Milton, and others imagined alternative marriage practices that influenced 19th century America. And that is the description of the subject I hope to present this morning. And maybe instead of just launching into it, I'll give you an outline of where I'm trying to go with this. This subject was really brought about by the Protestant Reformation and characteristics of printing and the availability of the Bible in people's hands, which used to be in Latin, unreadable by most people, and really out of the hands of the people. And so this was kind of a major change. And I wanted to begin with the earliest radical Reformation people, the Anabaptists, of which a group in 1531, the Dreamers, which practiced a reciprocal spouse exchange, was the first one, and then there was another Anabaptist group in Munster in 1834-35. And from then, I wanted to discuss the Reformation context of Christian polygamy and how polygamy came to America, the polygamy debate at least. And there are several pathways, one of which was the writings of John Milton, which were written in the 1600s but not published until 1825, and they were reviewed in 1826 in America, just a year or two before Joseph Smith was writing a prescription against polygamy in the Book of Mormon, a conditional prescription, which required certain things to happen, and then it would be allowed. So the timing is very close. If you think of the widespread reviews of Milton, who was very popular and very well known and really gave us the story of Adam and Eve as we preached it from the pulpit. It's pretty thin as you read it in the Old Testament, but Milton elaborated, and quite a bit of that is reflected in early Protestant preaching in America. So that's one connection. And then of course, we have the development of plural marriage in practice in 1831, perhaps the first date that is recognized as a possible request, which is coincidentally precisely 300 years after the Hessian and Thuringian dreamers practiced plural marriage of a form in 1531. So you have those two dates in mind, 1531 and 1831. To begin with, the context of Christian polygamy in the terms of the Reformation. Although the Mormons developed a unique practice of polygamy, it was not a new idea. And as we look at the context of Christian polygamy in the 16th century, we see a changed relationship between marriage and the church. The church had always controlled marriage, and several things happened. It went out of church law into natural law ideas. It was debated in Germany, England, Switzerland, and it takes part of that. Polygamy is part of that history of the debate of natural law replacing church law. The Protestant Reformation probably is dated by most people beginning in 1517 with Martin Luther when he nailed his complaints about the Catholic Church on the church door in Wittenberg, Germany, and initiated a popular religious and political revolution. Of course, Luther's protest against religious corruption had the momentous effect of replacing papal authority with the Bible, now printed in a language that people could understand. Luther helped to combine of the German dialects and form one national German language, which was very important because this allowed people to read the Bible in a language which they could understand, which of course didn't happen before. And a very similar thing happened in England. Henry VIII had the Bible printed in English. So in the Germany and German countries and in England, you now have all of a sudden people reading the Bible and discovering a whole lot of things, including the polygamous practices of the Old Testament, but also being part of this Reformation effort. Now, there were several aspects of the Reformation. There was the initial reformers, which was probably started, as we said, with Martin Luther, but other people as well. But they, the great reformers, were cautious. They basically reformed the church, but there was a second wave who said, well, okay, you've reformed the church, but let's go further. We want to restore the old church. This is too timid. It's not far enough. And so we have reformers, then restorationists. And in German, the term is restitution, quite often used. And the radicals, who were Anabaptists, wanted to go beyond Reformation to the restoration of the early Christian church. They said that Luther tore down the house, but he built no new house in its place. And so as the Anabaptists sought to restore apostolic Christianity, this also went back to an Old Testament interest, and something called Adam mysticism developed, where the primitive church was either the early apostolic church or something going back even further. It sounds a little bit like Mormon doctrine, where Mormons consider themselves chosen people as Hebrews, and there's quite a reaching back to both Jewish and Christian origins. Now, the Anabaptists were radical enough, but then there's a third wave which says the radicals didn't go far enough. Not only do we want to restore the original church, but look what's happening. The end of the world is coming, and we want to restore it now. And this is where we get to the Thuringian and Hessian dreamers and where we get to the Anabaptists in Munster. The Dreamers were basically begun with two families of peasants from Erlangen, Germany, called the Dreamers, who practiced reciprocal spouse exchange. The term spiritual marriage, of course, anticipates the 19th century term spiritual wifery. These two families of Dreamers, in these families, the men would be fathers to all the children of the wives, holding families in common as they held goods in common. So that was kind of a communism and polygamy brought together in this one community of related people. Although the men administered a patriarchal society, it was the women who insisted that they initiated the unions after hearing the voice of God. They described their sexual acts as corresponding to the will of God rather than self-initiated. So here's this wonderful thing that's happening, but it's not between people. Somebody else is outside. Some great force is pushing this, which is really an interesting idea. And these Hessian Dreamers, or blood friends as they were known, proposed that fleshy mingling, their term, the sexual act, to be the true and souled sacrament. And they considered the body itself to be the bridge to the divine. In about 1550, their leader, Louis of Tungeda, replaced baptism as a covenant with sexual spiritualism that sacramentally unified the fellowship by a single dream-inspired coition. According to the confession of an interrogated dreamer, sexual intercourse with a pure woman could bring salvation if she were of his faith and if she had intercourse willingly and believed. The belief is critical in this community to make this valid. The more mainstream reformers at that time would have been reducing the sacraments. There were many sacraments to just two, the baptism and the Eucharist, and separated marriage from its sacramental status, placing it under secular, not church authorities. But the Dreamers and other radical reformers, by making marriage or even specifically the sex act a sacrament, reversed the direction of the Reformation. The Reformation was moving on in a social way, and they reversed this. Well, you can imagine that these guys were a little far out for some of the other people, and in the eyes of other Protestants like Martin Bucer, Zwingli, and others, this was considered inappropriate, and there was quite a bit of resistance. The other group that we want to mention, of course, is the Anabaptists of Munster, who considered themselves Latter-day Saints. The Latter-day Saints of 16th century Germany. They were a community that practiced polygamy as they waited for the end of the world. They were radical Protestant reformers who saw apostasy in Luther's movements. So Luther's a reformer, but by not going far enough and backing off, he himself was seen as an apostate. The Anabaptists opposed infant baptism of both Catholics and Lutherans and believed that since baptism was dependent upon a recipient's faith, adult baptism was necessary in order to make a valid commitment. And so the name rebaptizer came up, which is why the word Anabaptist developed. That is the term which refers to rebaptism. The Munster polygamists were moved by apocalyptic texts of Daniel and revelations in the Bible. And becoming impatient with Luther and Calvin, they uh, uh, expected the end of the world to come within a short period of time. As these radical Anabaptist reformers began practicing, which was a little earlier than the 1530s, it was about 1521, 1522, 1524, the civil authorities and the church authorities in Holland, Switzerland, and Germany disapproved punished these people in terms of jail and execution. The radical Anabaptists took control of Munster in February of 1534 and designated the site as the New Jerusalem. In the words of the German historian Ralph Klotzer, quote, "It was here that the saints should gather to complete God's will and, at the return of Christ, inherit the latter-day kingdom of peace." So here we have the term Latter-day Saints used in this period 300 years earlier than the Mormons. In Munster, they prepared for the millennium by adopting a strictly primitivist religion, which included a restoration of Old Testament polygamy. One of the main leaders who took over this movement, John Bockelson, arrived in Munster in 1534 and found a congregation at that time already there of 1,400 baptized members, about one-fourth of the adults in the city, a majority of whom were probably women. Bockelson, known as Jan of Leiden, he was from Leiden, Holland, a tailor, led the Anabaptists during 11 months of polygamy where they lived in anticipation of the apocalypse. He purified Munster of all infidels, about 10,000 Catholics and Lutherans, so that it might become the New Jerusalem. He urged faithful Anabaptists everywhere to come to Munster. And his words recorded were, "I do not simply tell you about it, but command you in the name of the Lord to obey without delay." And from North Holland they came by hundreds. From South Holland they came across the Zuider Zee by boat. From other parts of the country they came by foot, horse, cart. It was a massive migration. Some say up to 14 or 16,000 pilgrims from Holland and Germany who went to the town of Munster in Germany, many of which were intercepted and killed on the way. Anabaptism developed into a popular movement, if you will, a priesthood of all believers, including sailors, fishermen, small businessmen, workers suffering from hard times. This was part of a kind of a social gathering as well as a religious gathering. The town of Munster endured disruptive struggles between national leaders, the church, the Habsburg emperor. Anabaptist apocalyptic teachings provided a biblical rationale for popular revolt. There were circumstances of unrest in the Netherlands in the early 1500s which produced conditions that led to this dissatisfaction and eventual revolt. There was economic stagnation, trade blockade, bread shortages, and lots of small popular revolts. A peasant revolt, if you will, of peasants versus the dukes, and there were trade guilds inspiring uprisings in the 1520s. As a university and ecclesiastical center, Munster became a gateway for spreading the news. Jan of Leiden called a general meeting and said that the father had further revealed to him that Israel, Munster, was to have a new constitution set up by God. John appointed 12 men as elders of the 12 tribes of Israel and was himself designated as the God-chosen king, son of David, who is to rule over the world until, as they spoke, God the Father would take back the scepter. On August 31, 1534, the prophet Johann Dutz and Schuer presented a vision in terms of Jeremiah 23:2-6 and Ezekiel 37:21, which declared Jan of Leiden the new king of Zion. Claiming the authority of a prophet, Bachelson issued 12 articles which he said had been revealed to him. One of the articles required that women should recognize their husbands as lords. One of the articles, another, declared that a man might take to wife as many women as he wanted. As Bachelson's followers proclaimed him to be king, he took 16 wives who were considered queens. Again, the language, consider the similarity of the language which you might have heard recently. 14-year-old males and 12-year-old females were deemed to be of marriageable age and were ordered to marry. An observer wrote, "Some of the women and girls stayed on after he had preached, danced about, and cried in a loud voice, 'Father, Father, Father, give, give, give.' Then they kept up, leapt up, raised their hands to the sky, and clapped. Their hair undone hung round their neck and down their back. They stared at the sun and imagined that God the Father was sitting up there in his glory. Then they danced like maenads in pairs through the streets and gazed at the sun till they were exhausted, white, and deadly pale." So here's quite a dramatic description of the enthusiasm with which these people followed this movement. Now, in Munster, the woman was subordinate to the man, as the soul and community of saints were to Christ, the heavenly husband. A mystical synthesis produced a sacramentally conceived sense of marriage that made polygamy, overseen by the Patriarch of Munster, a possibility. Unmarried women were required to accept the first husband, the first man who asked them. And this led to a disorderly competition for the most wives. Eventually, women were allowed to refuse unwelcome suitors. Married Anabaptist women found additional wives for their husbands, as Sarah had done for Abraham in biblical times, and, of course, as you know, as Mormon wives would do for their husbands in the 1800s. As with the Mormons, men often married their wives' sisters. The man with the most wives was considered the best Christian. They had some strong theoretical underpinning to this movement. There was a theologian, Bernhard Rothmann, who became Bachelson's primary spokesperson. Rothmann sent Anabaptist papers to Lutheran theologians in Marburg, which were returned and debated by the Munster City Council. And in 1533, this is 1 year earlier, they were then forwarded to Martin Bucer in Strasbourg, also a center of Reform and Anabaptism. By 1534, the Lutheran reformers realized they had a problem in Munster. Not only Anabaptists, but really radical Anabaptists, so it's two stages further. After Rothmann's restitution, again think of restoration, in October of 1534, in which he defended polygamy and kingdom, and his dispatch of 28 Munster apostles to proselytize in various cities, the Wittenberg reformers responded, including Luther, Melanchthon, Bugenhagen, and von Amsdorf. For 3 days, Rothmann preached in the Munster marketplace, saying that plural marriage was appointed by God for the new Israel, which he had restored in Munster, and Rothmann himself had acquired 9 wives. He justified polygamy not only by the example of the Hebrew patriarchs, but he also recalled the Lord's exhortation in Genesis 1:28 to Adam and Eve to, quote, "be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth," that their progeny, as promised for Abraham's seed, would become as numerous as the sand which is upon the seashore, which is from Genesis 22:17. Following this biblical prescription, the Anabaptist leaders at Munster sought to enlarge their community with progeny pure and numerous enough to qualify their people for a place among the 144,000 saints, that's 12,000 for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, in the biblical holy city which would be spared apocalyptic destruction at the end of the world. So this is all very related to the ability to read understand, maybe in quotes, interpret for themselves the meaning of the Bible. Mormon scripture singles out similar references to Israel as numerous as the sands of the sea. This is in the Book of Mormon, 2 Nephi 20 and 22. Rotman advised, if a man is so richly blessed that he is able to fructify more than one woman, I think that's a coined word, he is free to do so. Besides, he counseled, if a man is sexually dependent on one wife, she then leads him about like a bear on a rope, which of course is true. Rotman argued that women who everywhere have been getting the upper hand should submit to men as man to Christ and Christ to God. In a similar patriarchal vein, Brigham Young would announce in the Mormon temple at Nauvoo that women will never get back to God unless she follows the man back. The man must love his God and the woman must love her husband, unquote. As with the Mormons, Anabaptist polygamy met difficulty both within and outside the community. Forced cohabitation led to dissension. Bockelson jailed and even executed prominent members who refused to cooperate. The surrounding German community found the practices of the Anabaptists to be intolerable. So here you have the city with the surrounding Lutherans, Catholics, and various stages of radical reformers. These folks, in their opinion, had gone too far. Luther refers to the Anabaptist rabble in Munster, and by 1533 had written to Munster twice, once to theologian Rotman, once to the city council. His new disclosures from the Rebaptists of Munster, that's a title, contained a comprehensive report of events in Munster. The unsuccessful storming of the city on 31 August 1534, and the dispatch of 28 Baptist apostles. In Munster, Luther saw signs of the last days, the workings of demonic powers which would precede the apocalypse at the end of time. It sounds like this radicalized Luther somewhat. It was for him a sign of things going wrong. He writes, oh, what should I and how should I even write against these miserable people in Munster? The gross example of devil's play in Munster. What spirit would try to harm faith by going off and taking more wives or husbands? But to be so ashamed as to claw at the crown and as many women as one's desires and impertinence allow, let alone a wife. Luther suggested that the Anabaptists should be punished, but not by earthly opponents. He writes, no matter how you judge the Anabaptists, they are doing wrong, blaspheming and dishonoring God's discipline. It is nevertheless not correct, and I am dreadfully disappointed to see this, that one murders, burns, and gruesomely kills such wretched people. One should let everyone believe what he wants to believe. If his faith is incorrect, he will be punished enough by the eternal flames in hell. So he was saying, don't take the law into your own hands, which was already happening, but he's promising them an unfavorable future. In February of 1534, von Leyden's hierarchy was established, and Munster was designated the New Jerusalem, which we already said. It was here the saints should gather to complete God's will and at the return of Christ inherit the kingdom of peace. In February, the Catholic bishop, Franz von Waldeck, hired about 8,000 mercenaries with 40 cannon, ordered a blockade. As we mentioned, the attack in August was unsuccessful. The later attack was successful. The Munster population that year was about a little less than 10,000, including 900 armed men, 5,500 women, and about 3,200 children. On February 28th, there was the confession. Let's see here. What time do we have?
We've got 25 minutes.
Okay. I'll be through in just a moment, and we'll have questions. At one point in 1534, von Leyden dissolved the city council, which was the organized body to rule Munster, and replaced it with theological law. And like the Thuringian dreamers, marriage was validated only for men and women who had embraced the baptism of belief. So with these third derivative radicals, if you will, belief was very important in practicing what they did. It was not just random pleasure or whatever you might call it, but you know, a very considered action. After the invasion in 1535 ended the whole prospect of Munster Anabaptist polygamy. They put the leaders to death, and it is so said that although this city is surrounded by Protestant communities, Munster has remained predominantly Catholic ever since. And after the fall of Munster, the Anabaptist movement splintered into various factions. And one of these, led by Menno Simons, became the Mennonites of Holland and the Mennonites of America. The Mennonites of Holland were the Protestants of Holland, and the ones that came to America were much more radical than that, but nothing like happened here. Menno rejected both war and end-of-world concerns. The apolitical and pacifist Anabaptism spread back to Switzerland, where the movement really began in the 1520s, and then, of course, the Mennonites with the Amish form would bring pacifist lifestyles and plain living to the United States. These were the two groups that actually practiced polygamy. From then on out, you have a period of a couple of hundred years where people discuss polygamy. And part of the question is that divorce is forbidden. In many cases, someone needs a child to continue the family or in a political sense. And so what do you do if you don't have children? You can't have divorce. So a second wife is considered an alternative to divorce. And that's the issue that's quite discussed. There are other issues that are social issues. If you have more women than men in a community, if men are killed in war, how do you take care of them? How do you limit the social evil as they considered in the growing cities, prostitution? If you have every woman assigned to a family in some sense, there are various social benefits. And this was discussed quite a bit. The problem was the leaders, Luther and others, couldn't allow plural marriage in any form openly. It was too much for that, for the cautious reformers, if you'll call them that. But they couldn't refuse the political leaders who they be allowed to take a second wife. And the case in 1526 of Philip of Hesse, who was a ruler over one of the first Lutheran German states and organizer of political alliances within Germany, he asked Martin Luther if he might follow the example of Old Testament patriarchs and take a second wife. Luther answered on November 28, 1526, quote, "About that other matter, it is my faithful warning and advice that Christians especially should not have more than one wife, not only because it is a scandal." He said that some Old Testament patriarchs did have many wives by necessity, as Abraham, Jacob inherited the wives of their friends under Moses' law. It is not enough for a Christian to appeal to the conduct of the patriarchs, however. He must also have a divine word for himself. He advised against the second marriage unless there be the highest need, as, for example, if the wife have leprosy or is taken away from the husband in some other way. So he leaves the door open, and a decade later, when Philip wanted to marry a 17-year-old Margarethe von der Saal, Luther and other Protestant leaders responded with a public no and a private consent. But when Philip's dual marriage became public knowledge, both the political and religious establishments were embarrassed. The example of King Henry VIII, of course, is very well known. He was granted permission for a second wife by Luther in a private way. Before he was able to arrange an annulment of his marriage, to Catherine of Aragon, who had no male heirs that she bore for Martin for Henry VIII. He appealed for years to Catholic and Protestant leaders to marry Anne Boleyn, an attractive woman who was willing to wed the king. In 1531, Luther consented and cited the Old Testament precedent, although divine law opposes divorce, it permits the king to marry a second queen by the example of the patriarchs who had many wives even before the law. And I don't think we have time to go into all the writers, but we have Augustine made some comments regarding a second wife, the Enlightenment jurist Thomasius. It was really a debate among politics and religion, again, as the issues of marriage went into natural law, away from church law. Now we get to a point where this starts to come over to America, and I think we've this is not an example you haven't heard before, but it's an important one. This is Martin Madan in London in the 1780 period, who was a disciple of John Wesley in the Methodist faith. He wrote a three-volume work arguing for religious legitimacy and social benefits of polygamy. The work is called Philopthora, or A Treatise on Female Ruin, and his arguments were social in their motivation. He quoted John Milton, which is how we get into Milton, who was a long silent advocate for polygamy, on the title page, arguing that polygamy was valid according to Old Testament practice and allowed by God himself, and Christ did not say it wasn't appropriate. So he, from both the Old and New Testament, in different ways, finds justification. He saw polygamy as a necessary alternative to divorce and remarriage. Again, this was prohibited by the Bible passage which accuses the man of adultery who will put away his wife and marry another. That's in Deuteronomy 24:1 and Mark 10:10-12. And he refers to the polygamy in Genesis when Lamech took unto him two wives. But aside from religious justification, he went on to say polygamy was socially useful. If a man entices a virgin and lies with her, as he quotes, says, this shall be surely his wife as much as the first. It would be equally criminal to abandon her as to put away the first. So really, he really has a social motivation. Discussion of polygamy reached the United States and can be found in conversations within early New England churches, in sermons, and from congregations. One Dr. John Minor argues the doctrine of polygamy in 1780 at the Norfolk, Connecticut Village Church, claiming there were others in the church who concurred. He was excommunicated. Martin Madan's Philopthora had been quoted up into the later periods, up into the 1860s in the United States, as late as 1869. The most important treatise, again, I think, is John Milton's, which reappeared in 1825. It had been suppressed for 150 years because it was decreed too sensitive a subject in England in the mid-1600s. That's the time when Milton wrote his treatise on Christian doctrine, in which he argued the lawfulness of polygamy from the Bible. And I think we already mentioned the approximate time of the review of Milton, 1826, and the period of writing the Book of Mormon, which arguably 1828, 1829, maybe 1827, but certainly 1828. And besides the Mormons in the New World, there were other groups that did practice some form of new marriage forms. Jacob Cochran, in about 1817, had a utopian village, which was they called their practice spiritual matrimony. So you have spiritual marriage, spiritual matrimony, spiritual wifery, very similar terms. This was in Maine and New Hampshire, sanctioned by a ceremony of his own within which any man or woman already married or unmarried might enter into choosing at pleasure a spiritual wife or spiritual husband. Cochran reportedly had a regular harem consisting of several hundred unmarried females. And and often talked about person involved in group marriage, of course, is John Humphrey Noyes in the 1830s. I think at this point we probably should close and go into questions. The theme that follows each of these practices of plural marriage involves willingness and belief. The willingness to participate and the belief which motivates the practice. And it does span this 300-year period from 1531 to 1831 and, of course, further. Thanks.
Sure. What is our time, by the way?
We'll have Mr. Smith repeat the questions he understands and then comment. So, in the back there.
The audience is very largely male. I'm not sure. My question is, you guys are the numbers guys. You have mathematical brains, right?
No. Is it socially useful to have 15 or 20% of the population males roaming around without women? No, it's dangerous. I think people have talked about that, and it's been an issue, but I think there are statements that say that question the numbers and say, well, men go off to war and they lose men. In certain times, there were lots of parts of populations killed by disease, cholera, tuberculosis, various forms of plagues. Whether they count the people accurately, I think you're right, though. I think there are lots of people remaining in populations unmarried, even when the numbers are equal. Please. That's maybe I should stand.
Sure. Go ahead.
That's a very good point. Faith communities are often populated by females. And do you know numbers? Do you have statistics on that? I don't, but I think that's correct.
My personal
okay. Please.
Could you give us a summary of your book in this paper? Shall we go read it?
It's always good to read to make sure it's documented. There isn't a book at hand. There's a lot of research underway, and I would say this would not be a summary. of it's just a certain aspect, perhaps.
This book isn't published yet. There is one.
Oh, that was in Dialogue. And that was published. Who's our Dialogue editor here? That was before your time. I think it was 1992, something like that. Yes?
What's the likelihood that Joseph?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure one can give a definitive answer. The review of Milton's work in 1826 was widespread in Europe and America, and him being so well known and popular, and Paradise Lost was, you know, read and known and appreciated. There was an argument about Anabaptism that permeated the New England area in the 1800s about rebaptism and who the Anabaptists were. And let's see, I wish I could think of his name. He's a person who writes, I think he's a church scholar who's commented about the issue of Anabaptism being perhaps not polygamous Anabaptism precisely, but Anabaptism being an issue in Joseph Smith's neighborhood. I think he makes that connection. Whether anybody was arguing or knew about the practice at that time, I think there was a certain bearing of that. I think that was so painful for the other Anabaptists and the other Protestant reformers that was kind of willfully forgotten for a while. And I believe there was a lot of digging into Mennonite records, Anabaptist records, as late as the 1950s, which brought it up and made it a lot more well known. I really can't answer that. If somebody has an answer to that, I think that would be useful. Does anybody know about that? Please. I'm sorry, I didn't understand. If that happened, what is that again?
If Joseph Smith would have had influence by Milton or earlier on.
Oh, it might have been later. Uh-huh. Well, the Book of Mormon does address polygamy, however, and it doesn't just say only one man, one wife. It says polygamy is forbidden unless. And the unless is, unless I come and tell you that for the purpose of raising righteous seed, I will command you to do that. And it was, so the Book of Mormon is published with that conditional proscription in 1830, and only 1 year later, in 1831, the request of missionaries to marry Indian women and produce offspring, in this case white and delightsome, it had another idea in there, but nevertheless people refer to that as the first requested practice of plural marriage by Joseph Smith. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just would like to point out that there's a pretty strong possibility that Joseph Smith Sr. was an Anabaptist or belonged to an Anabaptist society in Vermont. It's one of the documents
I should have read your volume one too.
Make sense of why he never baptized any of his children.
The comment was that Joseph Smith Sr. very likely had some involvement with an Anabaptist community, and which is why he might not have baptized his children. Now, where was this connection made, did you say?
The document, in part, is in Volume 1.
But where was the location?
In Cambridge, Vermont.
In Vermont.
In Vermont.
Okay.
Gary? The polygamy rhetoric aside, do we know how prevalent the practice was within that city or that particular group? Can you make comparisons between how it was practiced there and, say, Mormon spread mm-hmm. hierarchy?
To my understanding, in Munster, it was a requirement that everybody get involved in some kind of a marriage, usually a plural marriage. And they threw out people who didn't believe that, and they required those who did to do it now, and some people who refused were, at least one person was known to be executed, some were punished. It was a requirement that everybody participate. So there's kind of an ethnic cleansing, if you will, that took place in Munster in the year 1534, excuse me. That's a good question. I haven't heard anything about polyandry. That's a new issue. But were there more women than men? I don't think there was a. There could have been reduction of male population through conflict, through wars. But a very good question to follow up. It was not a privilege, it was a requirement, and in that sense, it was not, I don't believe it was a hierarchical privilege. I think it was a requirement for all people. Yes?
Do you find a connection possibly between the idea that the end of the world is coming and establishing polygamy?
Well, the people in Munster seem to have that connection, and as the early Latter-day Saint Church anticipated an end of the world, given the name Latter-day Saint, these were the latter days, and there was quite a lot of speculation about an end of the world. There seems to be a relationship. I think the relationship was, as things are coming to the end, reading the Book of Revelations, the Book of Daniel, these books in the Bible, that to develop a religious community that will be saved when the earth is destroyed, you follow exactly what those early church regulations were. I think that's correct. I think there is an association. Yes?
Okay.
You had
the group in Munster basically wiped out. Who was the leader
in
that?
Jan Bakkelsen of Leiden, Holland. Munster is in Germany.
I know, but where?
Where in Germany? Yeah, that's.
Is it the Habsburg?
Were they
the ones
that
invaded?
It was a Catholic invasion. Bishop of Waldeck invaded. Everybody supported the invasion. The Catholics, the Lutherans, you had, I think, the Anabaptists who weren't, the radical Anabaptists probably were happy to see the thing end. They were terribly embarrassed by it.
Okay, so there were Anabaptists. This was sort of a radical Anabaptist.
Yeah, there were the original church, the Catholic Church, if you will. Then there were the Protestants, the Reformers, and then there were the Restorationists, the Restored Church people, and then beyond that there were the Restored Church people now, the Munster Anabaptists and these and the Dreamers in Hesse.
In terms of
the radical form was essentially gone. Not exactly in 1535. There were groups. One group called the Battenbergers were sort of roaming bandits in the countryside. They'd have a wife here and a wife there, and they were sort of transient. But that didn't last for many decades, and kind of in a random way. And certainly by the end of the 16th century, that was gone.
But a form of Anabaptism, if you will, survived without.
There were several forms of Anabaptism that did survive. Yes. And some were pacifist, and some were mainstream Protestants, as the Anabaptists in Holland.
And then on the Dreamer.
Yes. That seems like, rather than a large community, maybe a family of related people, a smaller group.
The Dreamers?
Yes.
Okay. They had a different form of, well, it wasn't really polygamy, it was like communal marriage.
It was more like communal marriage. They were all Bible related.
Where did they get their sort of biblical or their foundation for practicing?
Well,
all of these,
each of these groups looked back to the practice in the Old Testament, the plural wives. Well, it's not so much polyandrous, it's polygynous. Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know how hard to emphasize solidly, but they were polygynous. They were a polygynous group. Yeah. Our last question, please. Did Martin Luther marry two nuns? I don't think Martin Luther would like me to comment on that. I don't know.
I showed it in the movie, Martin Luther.
Well, Martin Luther may have had another side, but I don't know about it. Thanks very much.